Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Dr. Rick Holm joins us today from the Janine Basinger Studio at Dakota State University for your weekly checkup. Dr. Holm, thanks for being here.
Well, I'm happy to be here, Lori. Thank you for including me.
All right. What's our topic for today? Because you have no show tonight, right?
We have no show tonight. Yeah. But you can go. We're going to be doing a show, actually, recording a show for later on polypharmacy, you know, too many drugs. So I thought maybe you and I could talk about that today.
You know,
the
we
show
watched,
will occur.
Go ahead. I interrupted. I got excited about the topic, and then I interrupted you. Go ahead and finish. The show will occur.
Well, I mean, it will occur sometime this spring. And so we've got a great guest list, and it should be a wonderful show.
Right. So we had a conversation yesterday with the Nova producer about the opioid epidemic, and one of the things, one of the many elements of that program was looking at Big Pharma and some of the responsibilities that sort of lay on the shoulder of pharmaceutical companies for really pushing the opioids that ended up being. And you and I have talked about that, you know, before. So this is the bigger conversation about pharmaceuticals and supplements and medication. Where do you want to start? You must have seen it so much in your practice.
It's so much easier to just give a pill prescription than to spend time with a person about changing their lifestyle.
Yeah.
And pills pile up. I mean, you know, in a lifetime, people come into the nursing home and they're on 20 pills. It's just a list that goes on and on. You know, it's interesting. Whenever a patient of mine gets hospitalized, I often will take the opportunity, if I haven't already done it in a big way, to just start anew. You know, try to stop everything that I can. Now, you know, people who are diabetic, they oftentimes need three or four medications, and people who have heart failure or heart disease will sometimes need three or four, and that can pile up. But just too many pills in this country, and I think we're pushed by the pharmaceutical industry to prescribe. We're pushed by the patient who watches the advertisement and wants us to prescribe. They come in wanting an antibiotic. Everybody's pushing for another pill when really the answer is oftentimes no pill. The answer is something else.
Do you find that physicians, because in this documentary they were in West Virginia and they were talking about at the time that the opioids were, you know, the doctors were really sort of, you know, writing a lot of prescriptions, they were being sued by patients who were saying you didn't do everything that you could to help
right.
me. So there was an incredible amount of pressure on the physicians from not only the pharmaceutical companies, but legally in their own practices. They had a lot to sort of parse out.
And, you know, part of that also is that we are now, this is the world of protocols. And I remember when protocols started coming in, the protocols say, you know, when you've got a heart attack, you need to have the baby aspirin. When a person comes in with sepsis, you have a short period of time that you need to do to start antibiotics. The shorter the period, the better. You know, there's reason for protocols. But now what they've done is protocols at every turn, something like 11% of them are based on level A data, and 89% are based on B and C data, mediocre or poor data. Mm. So we are being evaluated, physicians and PAs and nurse practitioners, as far as the quality of care we provide by whether we follow the protocols. And that's the insurance company, it's the government, it's, many of those protocols ask for more medicine, and many of those protocols are not really scientifically based or poorly based science.
So this is
a bad time.
Yeah.
For
as a patient, can I go into my doctor, have a conversation? Is there language that I can use that sort of releases them from having to do that? Can I say, I want to know what's not, you know, let's stop talking about the protocol. Like, what do I say to sort of encourage my doctor that, like, well, let's look at some other things here so I can hear what you think as a person, not just what is the protocol?
Doctor, I just want you to know I'm not seeking another medicine unless it's absolutely necessary. And by the way, are there any medicines that we can stop?
Mm.
And so I'm not recommending from my, I'm not your doctor, you listeners out there. Don't stop your medicines.
Right. Yeah, let's be clear.
Talk to your doctor.
Yeah.
Or your PA or your nurse practitioner and say, you know, I'm coming in, I've got a sore throat, but I'm not asking for an antibiotic. I'd rather no antibiotic. But I'm worried and I want someone to see this and make some recommendations.
Right.
And by the way, do I need all these pills? You know, every time I try to stop a medicine if I can, you know, I look at that list of pills and think about reducing them.
What's the role of the pharmacist in this? Because I have a pretty good relationship with my pharmacist, and there have been times over the last 20 years as a parent, well, 17 years as a parent, but 20 years of knowing the same pharmacy that I go back to,
yes,
where they have been able to say to me, I don't know if this is the right choice, and we've been able to talk about it at the pharmacy counter. What's the role of pharmacists in adjusting medications?
Yeah, the pharmacist can make recommendations, but you need to go to your care provider, who is a prescriber,
right,
to make sure that they know the pharmacist's recommendation. Now, I mean, I'm constantly having oversight done by a pharmacist who is looking at my medications in the nursing home, or is looking at the medications that, you know, that I'm prescribing as an outpatient or in the hospital. The PharmD is always kind of over your shoulder looking at whether you're doing it right or not and whether,
sure,
you should do it differently. I initially was resentful when that came upon us, but I've come to realize that, you know, Lori, I'm not perfect.
And how did that happen?
You know, and all the suggestions, I don't have to take those suggestions. Sometimes they say I need to stop an antidepressant on a patient in the nursing home. They're required by law to recommend that I do that, that whenever they see a patient on an antidepressant that I stop it, or that I am advised to consider cutting the dose down or stopping it. And that's a wise idea. But oftentimes, that's the very best medicine the patient is on by far. And so, you know, it's tough enough to live anywhere in the world. But if you're living in an institution, and, you know, sometimes you need to have some little support there. So that is a medicinal support that I think is good. The tranquilizers, almost always bad. Not always, but, you know, many times bad. The narcotics, try to get them off those,
right,
medications. You know, the pills that help with bladder, those are oftentimes just filled with side effects. You know, there are sleeping pills, for the most part, bad news. So, I mean, you know, there are many medicines that we could do better by non-pharmaceutical means. And as far as pain goes, you know, I think we have to, as people in this country, we have to realize you can't get rid of all that pain. Sometimes that pain is telling you something. Covering it up is not a good idea. And I'm resentful of the 10 scale pain medicine scale.
Right.
And I made a fuss about that in my community hospital and my doctor's area. And they say, good news, we can't stop it now, but in 2 years, the government's going to take it away. Well, stop it. So anyway, the 10 scale, you know, on how much pain are you having? Well, shoot, no one is without pain.
Right.
Know, life is full of it. So,
we know we don't want to create a stigma for, you know, people who are taking medicines, but we also want to encourage them to really think about what they're taking and the side effects and the interactions. Do you, mm-hmm, just bring in, you know, when you come to see your doctor, you just bring in all your medications and say, let's look at this and talk about,
yes,
each one? Is that a good conversation to open the door?
Yeah. Yeah. I like people bringing in a brown paper bag full of all their pills, and then look at the pills I'm taking, and then they spill it out onto the table, or,
yeah,
you know, the examining table, and you look at all those pills and you go, okay, this one is really doing you something good. This one, we could probably cut that one out. This one, we could probably, you know. I think if the person is not wanting more pills and wants less, then, you know, generally we can try to, you know, provide that. We generally want our patients happy.
What about these pills that we take on our own? The vitamins, the supplements, the over-the-counter medication. How, you know, there's no doctor to sort of open that bag for. How do we know when we need those brightly colored boxes? And, you know, again, you won't necessarily suffer when relief is available, but how do we look at that and approach it?
Supplements many, many times have such modicum, such minimal effect that, they're not going to hurt anything except your pocketbook.
Right.
So the other side of that for me, when I'm looking at it, is that if you look, for example, on the woman's study, it was like 30 years long, and it was hundreds and thousands of women that were monitored, and they looked at the people that were on a multiple vitamin versus of people that were not on a vitamin of any kind, no difference in groups, no difference at all. And, we used to think maybe vitamin E was going to be helpful in preventing aging. And there was some biological, theoretical data. But they did a huge study, and they found no difference in the groups, except maybe just a slight worsening in the people getting vitamin E. What are the things that make a difference? There are certain times people are deficient in certain vitamins or minerals. Maybe they have an inherited mineral deficiency or so on and so forth. My conclusion is that in South Dakota, we are north of the line where we don't get enough sun and vitamin D by natural means for at least 6 months of the year. And so everybody that I care for usually are taking 2,000 international units of vitamin D in a capsule form. And anybody who has a neurologic issue, like numbness anywhere, tingling, or history of Alzheimer's disease in their family, I commonly would check for B12 levels, but I have everybody on 1,000 micrograms of vitamin B12 for that group. Those are the two vitamins that I think that I have some belief in, and that is D and B12. I don't say excessive amounts. I just say, if there's if there's any neurologic risk for you, our measurements for levels are not great for B12, and the consequences of dementia from B12 deficiency is significant enough. So I generally encourage B12, whether it's helping them or not. Probably not, but maybe.
Sure. And
all the rest, I think, are pretty minimal.
And, of course, the news out of Canada this week is the legalization of marijuana. So as we talk about pills and supplements and medication, medical marijuana, it's not legal in the state. But does it fit in other states? Are you looking at it sort of fitting into people's continuum of care?
Well, there's lots of data that supports that fact that whether it's CBD or whether it's THC or some component of the cannabidiols, there's pain relief from that medication. So if you look at what we're doing right now, 70,000 people, 45,000 completely for sure opioid deaths in 2017. Combined with other things, 70,000 deaths from opioids. Mm-hmm. How many from cannabinoids? How many from marijuana? And the answer is probably very minimal. Is it dangerous to our youth? Yes. So maybe we could be better if we legalize it in preventing our youth from taking it too early.
Do we medically know that because you'll hear law enforcement officers say, well, yeah, they're not dying from marijuana, but it's a gateway to things that are worse. Are there studies on that? Is it proven to be a gateway to other drug use, narcotic use that is more dangerous?
That's the standard word you hear from people who are running for office or who are in the judicial world. That's the standard spiel that you hear. It's just like the talking points they've been studying. I think the data to prove, I can prove that anybody who's on heroin at least sometime in their life drank milk. You know what I mean? I think if you look at here is a drug that is illegal and you can only get it around the corner when with your buddy down at the pool hall or whatever it might be, you know, is that opening the door and making you want to go to heroin after you've smoked marijuana? And the answer is, if you're the person that's taking the risk of getting it illegally, then you're probably going to be talking with people who can give you other things illegally. So I think the data is extremely poor in any of that entrance drug method, personally. Now, I'm giving you my bias. I don't have solid data one way or the other.
Right.
I just think it's very difficult to prove that it's a gateway drug. I think that's pretty much malarkey in my mind.